Baby, there we go. All right, good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, January 25th, 2016, and this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Monday, everyone, and it seems that Monday's starting out just like a Monday should, with my microphone somehow being disconnected, even though I haven't been out here since Friday. It is 32 degrees and pretty cloudy here in upstate New York. We did not get any of the snow like they did on the East Coast. I saw that New York City and Philadelphia, hope you dug out there, Shally. Sorry about that. Yesterday, have managed to see the sun. I actually caught a picture yesterday of JFK Airport. And there was a plane that was covered all the way up to the tippy top in snow. So I'm sure that that is pretty interesting. All right, where do we leave off Friday? We titled the show Small and Big Data, Internet of Things and You. And we looked at all kinds of things. Of course, we started out looking at Zika virus and some of the different illnesses going around. And we might get back there today for a little bit, but we ended the show looking at the Internet of Things, how they're bagging and tagging us, a warning from a mainstream publication saying exactly what we've been saying for the longest time, that every little thing that we give up to the machine becomes part of your dossier, becomes part of something that they can use to then create something else to monitor you more. They are selling this to the machine, to the corporations that are wittingly or unwittingly a part of this, as data that they can then create applications to sell you better products. I watched a video over the weekend that Solvner had dropped me, I believe it was Saturday, from the Consumer Electronics Show this year in Las Vegas, with the IBM CEO on stage. It was about an hour, and IBM, we've talked about IBM's Watson artificial intelligence quite a number of times. IBM's Watson is backending now a lot of cancer research at Sloan Kettering Hospital, I believe, is where they're using it. I also was reading that they were using it at the VA, doing diagnoses. They've been working on what they call cognition with artificial intelligence, and Watson is probably one of the leading products out there. They've commercialized it a couple years ago. They're selling it to different industries to be able to crunch large amounts of data and come up with solutions. Another one I remember seeing was the pharmaceutical industry. They were using Watson to go through all of the known drugs that they have and the chemicals in those drugs, and then have Watson find black box uses for those drugs, something black box being something that it wasn't necessarily approved and tested for, but that they go, oh, look at, this. I just saw one recently. It was like this chemotherapy medication works really well on Alzheimer's or something like that, something that it was never tested for, but whoops, look at, we have drugs in here that seem to show improvement in some other disease. So anyway, this Watson is back-ending a lot of the medical stuff right now, and it's rolling out. They sell Watson cloud services, so you can integrate with an IBM API into Watson to be able to do what they call cognition in your application. So anyway, the CES video that Solvner gave me, I was watching this weekend, and the IBM lady was talking about these three new partnerships that IBM had forged. 2016 is going to be the year of Internet of Things. And the first guy that came out, and I don't remember the name of the company, but he was a sports guy who had started an underwear company after playing football in high school or something. And it has morphed now into wearables using this Watson back-end cognition to be able to provide you just what we were talking about, a dashboard for real-time monitoring of your vital signs, just like the Fitbit, but now in clothes. Your vital signs, your heart rate, chemicals in your blood, give you recommendations for maybe some better exercises. Yesterday you didn't run as much, so today we're going to give you a workout that looks like this. It was pretty interesting, but it was exactly what we were saying. It'll be able to track you now to the next level. But then the second, so we started with the wearables. The second new partner was a company called Medtronics, and we have actually talked about them during the show before. Medtronics makes the diabetes inserts that'll be able to monitor your blood 24/7 to do sugar readings. And this is the first of many applications that they're looking at. And this would be the insertables, right? The implantables. And of course, this guy, the CEO of Medtronics on, and he was talking about how wonderful it is. They can predict a hypoglycemic event 3 hours before it ever occurs. So, you know, of course, it's going to save lives to have this implantable 24/7 tracking. And they show this little dashboard thingy that can give you recommendations on your food based upon what you've done today. And it's using, again, Watson on the back end to put the intelligence behind it. And then the third new partner IBM had was SoftBank, and we've talked about them as well. SoftBank with their new little robot called Peppa. Yes, Peppa. Peppa is a little artificially intelligent robot that they have been rolling out in Japan for the elderly, for retail and other things. And now they're going to put Watson's artificial intelligence behind Peppa as well. So put on a seatbelt, people, because IBM, the CEO from IBM, Ginny something, I don't remember her last name, had pointed out that this was the first time ever that IBM has ever presented at the Consumer Electronics Show. Now, for any of you who've been listening for a while, you remember a story I told a while back about the day I remember that computers were hitting the mainstream. I'll never forget that, because computers in the sale papers on Sunday, computers always used to be in their own separate section. They were in the electronics section, and only the geeks shopped in the electronics section. And then there was one Thanksgiving coming up to the holiday season, and I remember I'm sitting out here right on top of my keyboard, right where I'm sitting right now, flipping through my paper, and computers all of a sudden ended up in the consumer electronics section with like the handheld MP3 players and the stereos, and they were all in the same section. I remember saying to myself, wow, this is pretty significant, because it means the computers have moved beyond the realm of geek to the realm of everyday dumb end user. And that really was the takeoff. That was mid-90s. That was the takeoff to what we see today. So now we've had all this mad science go, man, that I've been talking about for the last couple years. It's all been in the science journals and hush-hush and too complicated for people to understand. And now here we have IBM, very first time showing up at a consumer electronics show to launch these three new partnerships. Wearables, implantables, and artificially intelligent robots, all back-ending to their cloud Watson cognitive intelligence that can be integrated to applications to be able to make you healthier and happier up to the minute with real-time dashboards with information about you. Be careful what you give up to the machine. That's all I got to say. There have been warnings galore. Robots are going to take your jobs. And the technocracy is going to take your freedom. And that's what this is all about. So where do we continue here? I ran across a story back last week that caught my attention. And it wasn't my attention. The title wasn't what caught my attention. It was who put out the story that caught my attention. It was titled, "Sadly, the Internet Isn't Making the World a Better Place." And this was out of course, MIT Technology Review. How interesting it would be them saying this. But they were doing a story on a report that came out of the World Bank. Now, the World Bank, of course, has everything to do with what's happening right now, right? All the rich guys who want to pull all the strings are involved in manipulating all the money. So it is in their best interest if we all get caught up in the grid. But the fact that they put out a warning, you know, as we're at the 99th percent ready for rollout, running toward the wall at 75 miles an hour. The World Bank comes out with a report that says, whoops, you know, this dangling carrot that we've been trapping you into and getting everyone to buy into and become as electronic as you possibly could and giving it all up to the machine, giving us DNA swabs and putting all your browser history and uploading all your pictures so we make sure that we have everything you could possibly want to know about you in our databases already. Well, guess what? It's not as good as we told you it was going to be. All right, anyway, sadly, the internet isn't making the world a better place. Tech companies, let's blame it all on the tech companies, are trying to hasten the spread of the digital revolution. But a new study suggests that it could do more harm than good. Ding, really? Yes, well, really. A brave new digital world is rapidly emerging as the internet, smartphones, and other technologies spread quickly throughout less wealthy nations. But could this sometimes be doing more harm than good? Well, you think? You know, and the great thing is remember, it's all the rich guys that are behind this digital revolution, all self-made millionaires, many of them, that now are funding a lot of the mad science research, along with DARPA and others. This is a fascinating new report from the World Bank, examines the impact that these digital technologies are having around the world. And it is a sobering reminder that the spread of technology isn't the panacea that many hope it will be. And remember, it was the panacea that they promised us in the 80s. You know, that great world where there was peace and no more hunger and no more disease. And we would all be living happily and healthily with creative pursuits being our utmost concern of the day, the way that Kurzweil still sees transhumanism. That's what they promised us through movies, through popular culture, through the promise of technology. It was going to fix it all for us. And people like me, who were in the industry, who saw this quite a number of years ago, said, oh, hold this phone. This is getting to be a little too invasive. Nobody even believed us about the spying back 10 or 15 years ago, and that's all proven to be true. Says the study did find positive aspects, which they call digital dividends, such as, of course, new economic growth in places like Africa, releasing all their Google balloons that never happened. They happened here. You know, I'd like to find out, too, somebody, if you're bored, let's see what happened to Project Loon. That was supposed to launch like right at the beginning of January, and they changed the entire project. It's not going to be over Africa now. Now it's over the United States. Anyway, it says it's such as new economic growth and increased access to education. But it states that there are also unevenly distributed technologies, especially in developing nations and poor countries, and individuals that lack access to technologies will fall behind their peers, the report warns, and in some cases, social inequalities could be exacerbated. As the New York Times reports, this contradicts some of the assumptions behind Silicon Valley's efforts to spread the internet to poor nations, such as Google's Internet by Balloon effort, Project Loon, and how weird New York Times is still talking about Project Loon over third world nations. But guess what? They changed it, right? We discovered that. Last minute change, approval by the FCC. Let's put microwave towers in the sky across the entire United States instead of Africa. As well as Facebook's subsidized internet service called internet.org. In India, Facebook's efforts, which provide only limited access to the internet beyond the social network, has indeed already come in for some severe criticism. It also seems like an important counter to an overarching philosophy of techno-optimism that sometimes seems to pervade the tech industry. Richer countries need to bear in mind that as well. The spread of more advanced digital technologies like artificial intelligence and robotics could start giving some companies huge advantages, right? Like companies such as, oh, was it SoftBank? I don't remember what the company was that was building the army of robots to then ship over to China to man all their factories, right? They've been working on that. It's going to put all those $2 an hour or $2 a day workers out of jobs, while, of course, eradicating and fundamentally changing many jobs. And that's kind of where we're going to start off here today. RT came out with a story. So this was all last week or the week before, and we've talked about all this, so it's not like it's new to us. Technological advances could kill 5 million more jobs by 2020. Guys, that's only 4 years from now. So if we think that we are in some deep shit now, just wait for another 4 years. And yeah, the Davos Economic Forum is going on right now in Switzerland. The World Economic Forum said that advances in technology combined with socioeconomic demographic changes could lead to the net loss of 5 million more jobs in 15 major economies in 2020. The report said that the job loss predictions were relatively conservative. So 5 million is relatively conservative. Quote, as many as 7.1 million jobs could be lost through redundancy, automation, and disintermediation, with the greatest losses in white-collar office and administrative roles, the World Economic Forum stated in its The Future of Jobs report released last Monday. The loss is predicted to be partially offset by the creation of 2.1 million jobs. Yeah, low-end bullshit jobs. And they say it's mainly in computing, mathematical, or architecture and engineering. Well, I say bullshit to that. You know, there's a lot of that stuff that's all going to be done now with AI and 3D virtual reality, printing, nanotech, small little factories that they can create things from an atomic level. That's all just waiting behind door number 1, 2, 3, and 4. The first of its kind report was released on the eve of the group's economic forum, where 2,500 leaders from the business, government, and civil society will participate, and this was last week, in an annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland. The future of jobs will be the central topic for discussion. Wouldn't you like to be a fly on the wall there? Referring to the transition as the fourth industrial revolution, the report says that the job losses will come about because of developments in artificial intelligence, machine learning robotics, nanotechnology, 3D printing, genetics, and biotechnology. Ding, ding, ding. Wow. Seems to be every topic that we have discussed on this show. Those developments will lead to widespread disruption, not only in business models, but also in the labor markets, with, quote, enormous change predicted in the skill sets needed to thrive in a new landscape, unquote. So basically, get on the ball, get some new skills. Otherwise, we are all going to be migrants someday. I just saw a story yesterday, too, about plugging in the American dream into Google. And I didn't do this, but we should. And how there are so many now different assisted searches that say the American dream no longer exists. The American dream is dead. And I would believe that. All you got to do is take one look at a place like Flint, Michigan, or up in anywhere. Any of the steel cities, any of our cities, especially our infrastructure, including like bridges or mining. Like I saw in LA, man, that methane leak is way beyond anything they ever imagined now. Radioactive water in Texas and lead water and Flint and who the hell. And these are just the stories that we know about. Up near in Washington State, we have all the Manhattan Project waste. And in Missouri, we have all that Manhattan Project waste. In Buffalo, we have all the Manhattan Project waste. But don't worry about it. We got Fukushima burning down. And it's beyond any science that we have to cure it. But it won't affect you. It won't affect you at all. It's just unbelievable. We're going to use technology to put us all out of jobs, but we're not using technology to fix anything that's going on. And be careful what you ask for, though, because that's where the DARPA lady said, of course, we're going to use the synthetic biology, was to fix all of these environmental disasters. Anyway, back to the story. Two areas of job growth identified through the survey were data analysts to crunch the torrents of data generated and collected by organizations, as well as sales representatives. And this is what IBM was talking about yesterday, skilled in commercializing and explaining a company's offerings to clients and investors. Now, I don't think that data analysts, again, are going to be a growing field since the algorithm will be able to do that. All you need is a better algorithm to be able to make sense of your data, and IBM Watson will do that for you. Other areas of growth were a new type of human resource and organizational development specialist, as well as jobs involving engineering skills in materials, biochemical, nanotech, and robotics. So that puts about 90% of the population out of a job. The biggest losses were expected to be in healthcare, yes, because Watson's taking over, followed by energy, financial services, and investing. And big job creation is anticipated in information and communication technology, professional services and media, as well as entertainment. The report said that job losses would be felt equally between women, 48%, and men, 52%. But as men represent a larger share of the overall job market, women are expected to lose 5 jobs for every 1 gained, compared to men losing 3 jobs for every 1. Reskilling employees was cited, of course, as the most popular workforce strategy for how best to deal with the quote-unquote sweeping changes that are about to overtake our workforce, in addition to supporting mobility and job rotation. So, yeah, let's make sure that we all move around, going from job to job. Make sure we also have you trained in like 12 jobs so you can do anything that we have available because you're that desperate. And about 65% of children starting primary school today will end up working in jobs that don't yet exist. And their future training is crucial, according to the report. Yes, let's make sure we train the children and make them very receptive to being slaves. It is also noted that the most in-demand occupations or specialties did not exist 10 or even 5 years ago. And that pace is now set to accelerate. The report was based on a survey of senior executives from 350 companies across 9 industries in 15 of the world's largest economies, representing 65% of the global workforce. Now, there was another story about this very issue that I had queued up again out of MIT Technology Review. And this brings up a very good question. So as we're automating everything, as we're putting artificial intelligence into the back ends of things and allowing algorithms to scrape all of this big data and little data and put it into databases and then come up with conclusions based upon what it collects, who is going to own the robots? Well, very good question. Especially since there's a lot of tax dollars going in to develop a lot of this stuff. Who will own the robots? Well, we are in the midst of a job crisis, and rapid advances in AI and other technologies may be one culprit. How can we get better at sharing the wealth that the technology is creating? And very, very good question. The way Hod Lipson describes his Creative Machines Labs captures his ambitions, quote, "We are interested in robots that create and are creative," unquote. Lipson, an engineering professor at Cornell University, and this July he's moving his lab to Columbia University, is one of the world's leading experts on artificial intelligence and robotics. His research projects provide a peek into the intriguing possibilities of machines and automation from robots that evolve. And remember, we looked at those. There are robots that actually do evolve. They've shown it in research. One generation of robot creating the next generation will build in the best characteristics that they themselves have. From robots that evolve to ones that assemble themselves out of basic building blocks. And we also looked at the self-assembling, and that exists already. His Cornell colleagues are building robots that can serve as baristas as well as kitchen help. And a few years ago, Lipson demonstrated an algorithm that explained experimental data by formulating brand new scientific laws, which were consistent with ones known to be true. He has, in essence, automated scientific discovery. Did you get that? He actually demonstrated an algorithm that was able to come up with brand new scientific laws by looking at all kinds of data and then extrapolating what laws would apply to that. And it's been working. He's literally automated scientific discovery. So if we can have robots doing the scientific discovery, it's pretty horrifying. Lipson's vision of the future, oh, can't wait to hear this one, is one in which machines and software possess abilities that were unthinkable until recently. But he has begun to worry. Wow, took him long enough. I mean, I've already been worrying for a while. He's begun to worry about something else that wouldn't have been unimaginable to him a few years ago. Could the rapid advances in automation and digital technology provoke a social upheaval by eliminating the livelihoods of many people, even as they produce greater wealth for others? And you know, the thing is, they've been talking about this for so long now, like, oh, all this great stuff. Don't worry about it. It's going to get rid of jobs, but we'll worry about that when we get there. And now they're putting up the alarms because we are at the 11th and a half hour. They are opening the doors and they have released the hounds. And now it's too late to do anything about it. And yeah, it's going to create great wealth for all the rich fuckers, just like everything else, and put us all out on the streets. More and more computer-guided automation is creeping into everything from manufacturing to decision-making, says Lipson. And in the last 2 years alone, and you know, I'm going to point something out. I've been telling you guys this is coming a lot faster than they say. And we've been reading story after story. They're like, oh, all those stories of doom and gloom. They're just, it's 20, 30 years out from now. And now we're starting to see them going, oh, guess what? It's not 20, 30 years out. It's here. It's coming. Wow, it's happening fast. And yeah, it is happening fast. I think 2016 is the year, people. The seatbelts better be snapped in because it's coming. In the last 2 years alone, says Lipson, the development of so-called deep learning has triggered a revolution in artificial intelligence, and 3D printing has begun to change the industrial production process. For a long time, the common understanding was that technology was destroying jobs, but also creating new and better jobs, says Lipson. But now, now, guess what? The evidence is that technology is destroying jobs and indeed creating new and better ones, but also fewer. And it is something as technologists we need to start thinking about. Yeah, the only jobs that it is creating are going to be the jobs where you work for the overlords watching the robots. That's about it. Building the dashboards. Making sure the robots and the artificial intelligence and the automation is doing what it's supposed to be doing. We read that story about the Chinese factory that made mice and keyboards. And I don't remember what the numbers were, but they were staggering where it was like, God, I wish I could remember. The numbers were just beyond staggering. Like it took a whole factory a whole day to make like 800 keyboards and mice or something. And now it would only take a half an hour for this robotic factory to do the same thing. It was just staggering. And then amplify that across the world in all these different factories and add to that the TPP, where now we're negotiating country to country for who's going to have the cheapest slave labor. And you're going to see that there's a pretty scary picture that is forming here. Worries that rapidly advancing technologies will destroy jobs dates all the way back to the 19th century. You chicken little, so don't worry about it. During the Industrial Revolution in England and in 1821, a few years after the Luddite protest, the British economist David Ricardo fretted about the substitution of machinery for human labor. And again in 1930, during the height of the Worldwide Depression, John Maynard Keynes famously warned about, quote, technological unemployment caused by our discovery of means of economizing the use of labor. Now, technology is once again under suspicion as rising income inequality confronts the United States, Europe, and most of the rest of the developed world. A recent report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development concluded that the gap between rich and poor is at a historically high level in many of its 34 member countries, driven largely by a drop in earnings power from the bottom 40% of the population. And that 40% is the disposable 40%, people. This is where the plagues are going to come in handy. You wait and see. I don't know if we're going to get time to talk about it today, but I have seen a couple disturbing things over the weekend. There's an outbreak here and an outbreak there of some mysterious new flu that's already put a bunch of people into the hospital and people on ventilators. No cure. They don't know what it is. And I've been waiting for them to pull out the stops. You know, I've talked about this before. It's one of my worst horrifying nightmares, and I've been waiting for it. So I got some people looking into some stuff. I'll let you know. Many of the lowest earners have seen their wages decrease over the last few decades. Well, all of us have. Whose wages have gone up? And even if your wages have gone up, the cost of living has gone up. The cost of food has gone up. The cost of heating has gone up because, oh, climate change. Climate change caused us to cull the animals and caused the droughts and caused all this other stuff. If the prices go up, they never come back down. And the value of your dollar as they print more and more qubits endlessly under QE, whatever we're at, QE to infinity, makes your dollar worth less and less every day. I would have to say that there's way more than the bottom 40% of the population that's suffering right now. What do we just see? 62 individuals? 62 individuals have more wealth than the rest of the planet? And yes, Bacon, I don't know about you, but one of those viruses I saw came out of some Don't Ask Ukraine website yesterday. It's the official publication for Don't Ask about this released virus that supposedly the U.S. was working on. So I'm not sure. I have someone looking into that, so we'll find out if that's for real. Anyway, many of the lowest earners have seen their wages decrease over the last few decades, and they are now warning that income inequality is now undermining economic growth. Meanwhile, the erosion of the American middle class, and yes, the American middle class is in free fall, as well as the pressure on the lowest paid U.S. workers, has been painfully evident for years. Only 68% of men between the ages of 30 and 45 who have a high school diploma were working full time in 2013. And median earnings for a man without a high school diploma fell 20% between 1990 and 2013, while those with a high school diploma dropped 13%. It is notoriously hard to determine the factors that go into job creation and earnings. So, of course it is, and it is particularly difficult to isolate the specific impact of technology from that of, say, globalization, economic growth, access to education, and tax policies. Well, yeah, you think globalization had nothing to do with it. Globalization was the first nail in the coffin with our international trade agreements. We had it with NAFTA. Now the TPP is going to be the big sucking sound out of this nation. Add to that robotics and artificial intelligence and an entire European migrant crisis because of endless wars all over Europe and the Middle East. And you're going to see that the future is looking like an episode of some dystopian science fiction film. At the same time, software and digital technologies have displaced many types of jobs involving routine tasks such as those in accounting, payroll, and clerical work, forcing many of those workers to take more poorly paid positions or simply abandon the workforce altogether. And add to that the increasing automation of manufacturing, which has eliminated many middle-class jobs over the past decade, and you begin to see why much of the workforce is feeling squeezed. Well, I want to know who's going to own all this. This is very long-winded. These are long-term trends that began decades ago, says David O'Toole, an MIT economist who has studied job polarization, the disappearance of middle-skilled jobs, even as demand increases for low-paying manual work on the one hand, highly skilled work on the other. It is called a hollowing out of the middle of the workforce, he says, and it has been going on for a while. Nevertheless, the recession of 2007 to 2009 may have sped things up in the destruction of the many relatively well-paying jobs requiring repetitive tasks that can be automated. These so-called routine jobs, quote, fell off of a cliff in the recession, unquote, says Henry Siu, an economist at the University of British Columbia, and there has been no large rebound. No, because the mantra was do more with less. Do more with less, Microsoft. That was their key phrase. Do more with less. Let's do double our duty in jobs, because guess what? You're happy with your job? Oh, you're unhappy with your job? Well, there are no jobs, so do double the work for the same amount of pay, or you'll have no job. That's how they played it. This type of work, which includes white-collar jobs and sales and administration, as well as blue-collar jobs and assembly work and machine operation, makes up about 50% of the employment in the United States. Whoa! Well, no wonder our jobless rate, the one that's not on the books, is somewhere around 40-some-odd percent, I was just told. Yes, it's pretty dire. Sue's research also shows that the disappearance of these jobs has most harshly affected people in their 20s, many of whom seem to have simply stopped looking for work. And yes, and they were all the kids who were sold a big fat bill of goods about going to college and getting a $100,000 loan to pay for it. And now there are no jobs. That's bad enough, but now there's an even more fundamental fear, and this is a harbinger of what is to come from other sectors of the workforce. Yes, gotta love harbingers. As technology takes over more and more of the jobs that have long been considered secure paths to a middle-class life, are we at the beginning of an economic transformation that is unique in history? Wonderful for what it could do in bringing us better medicine, services, and products, but devastating for those not in a position to reap its financial benefits like most of us. Oh, yes. And will software and robots replace most human workers? Well, no one knows that answer. Well, yes, they do know that answer. And yes, it is going to replace most human workers. Many economists see little convincing evidence that advances in technology will be responsible for a net decrease in the number of jobs. Well, no, they can't say that right now, so the stock market would go into free fall. Or that what we are undergoing is any different from earlier transitions when technology destroyed some jobs but improved employment opportunities over time. Still, over the last several years, a number of books and articles have argued that the recent advances in artificial intelligence and automation are inherently different from past technological breakthroughs in that they portend, in what they portend for the future of employment. Martin Ford is one of those who think that this is different. His new book, Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future, Ford points to numerous examples of new technologies such as driverless cars and 3D printing that he thinks will indeed eventually replace most workers. How will we then adapt to this new jobless future? How interesting, the dude's name is Ford too. He's probably like a disinherited cousin from the Detroit Ford family. I don't know, but it's funny that his name is Ford, talking about how this is going to displace, and Ford was the beginning of, like, the assembly line. Ford recommends a guaranteed basic income as part of the answer. And, you know, I told you guys I've been subscribing to some of these transhumanist lunatic groups out there just to see what kinds of things they're pimping. And I have read a few times now about this guaranteed basic income. Talk about, like, providing this dangling carrot of suckling to be dependent on the state, right? We've talked about that already. And, you know, I am all for having some sort of social safety net if you get yourself into trouble, so you at least can have the basic needs of heat and food until you get yourself back on your feet. But we have now generations of people that have been living on social assistance who have never been encouraged to, like, use their own brain and get off their ass and go do something. And I know there are people out there like, oh, well, we're disadvantaged. You know what, guys? I'm going to tell you what. I'm a woman. I grew up in the 70s and the 80s when women were not engineers. I went into a field that there were only two of us out of hundreds of technicians that were guys. I had people make sexist remarks constantly to me about, oh, well, I guess for a woman, you know what you're talking about type shit over and over again. My pay was always lower than the guys. And I ran circles around them. But hey, I taught myself. I got an English degree and learned computers on my own. And I didn't have a college education paid for by anybody. I worked three jobs and I did it myself. And I left a week after my 18th birthday for my parents' house. All right. So I didn't have any type of dangling carrots to help me. I didn't have any type of privilege. My one friend's like, well, you're white. Well, that doesn't matter. I'm a woman. I'm a woman who had no experience in an industry that was dominated by men. And I did it myself because I didn't take no for an answer. If I couldn't go through the door, then I tried to dig a hole under the door. If that hole didn't work, then I tried to break a hole through the top of it. And if that didn't work, I tried to go around it. And if that didn't work, well, then I just broke the door down. You know, you can't give up. And that's what being dependent on the state has encouraged people to do, to be satiated, to take what they give you and be happy with it, and then to cry about being a victim. Don't be a victim. Well, we're all going to be victims now because guess what? The jobs are gone. I just can't even believe that we're at this point now. And now they're talking about guaranteed basic incomes for everybody. So don't do anything. We'll just give you money. Simply put, his prescription is to give people a modest amount of money. It's not a new idea. One version of it called negative income tax was popularized by the conservative economist Milton Friedman during the 1960s as a way to replace some of the growing government bureaucracy. And Ford quotes the economist Friedrich Hayek, who in 1979 described assuring a minimum income as a way to provide, quote, a sort of floor below which nobody needs to fall, even when he is unable to provide for himself. Now, guys, I don't have issue with that. Some sort of social safety net we need to have, but this cannot be the end all. You cannot live on government dole for an entire country. Not only that, I mean, we're talking like this is globally going to take away the jobs. What are we going to do then? Both Richard Nixon and his 1972 presidential rival George McGovern, a liberal Democrat, championed some form of the policy. The idea went out of fashion in the 80s, but it's returned again in recent years as a way to help those people who are shut out of labor markets. And in the libertarian version, it is a way to provide a safety net with minimal government involvement. In the progressive version, it supplements other programs to help the poor. Whether it's good politics or good social policy has been endlessly debated, and recently others have suggested a related policy, expanding the earned income tax credit, which would give extra money to low-paid workers. These ideas probably do make sense as a way to strengthen society, but if you believe that rapid advancements of technology could eliminate the need for most workers, such policies do little to directly address that scenario. Ding, ding. Allowing a large number of workers to become irrelevant in a technology-centric economy would be a huge waste of human talent and ambition and would probably put an enormous financial burden on society. Right, it would make us all useless eaters, all of us. What's more, a guaranteed basic income does not offer much to those in the middle class whose jobs are at risk or to those who have recently fallen from financial security in the absence of well-paying jobs. It might also be premature to plan for a dystopian future of hardly any jobs. Well, I don't know about that. I'd be planning for it since apparently the complete hollowing out of the middle class by technology took you guys all for surprise. Maybe we should be planning on the complete loss of all jobs. Ford's Rise of the Robots offers many examples of impressive achievements in automation software and AI that can make some jobs obsolete, even those requiring highly trained professionals in fields like radiology and law. And yeah, we've talked about that. And Watson's going to take care of that. How do you assess just how specific technologies like these will affect our total number of jobs in the economy? In fact, there is not much evidence on how even today's automation is affecting employment. Guy Michaels and his colleague George Gates at the London School of Economics recently looked at the impact of industrial robots on manufacturing in 17 developed countries, and the findings tell a mixed story. The robots did seem to replace some low-skilled jobs, but their most important impact was to significantly increase the productivity of the factories, creating new jobs for other workers. Yeah, the ones who watch the robots, like I said. Overall, there was no evidence, none at all, that the robots reduced total employment. Well, I guess that should make us feel pretty safe then. All right, do we need to read any more of this bullshit? The credence Ford gives to Drexler's... Oh, wait, yeah, let's get to Drexler. As proposed by some nanotechnology boosters, molecular manufacturing, and we've talked about this in depth as well, most notably the author, Eric Drexler, the father of nanotechnology out of MIT, the idea is that one day it will be possible to build almost anything with nanoscale robots that move atoms around like tiny building blocks. And guess what? DARPA just released a project looking for bidders to do this very thing. And though Ford acknowledges that it might not happen, well, no, it is going to happen. He warns that jobs will be devastated if it does. Well, then I guess we better prepare for that. The credence Ford gives to Drexler's vision of nanobots slaving away in molecular factories seems less than warranted. Really? No, it's very warranted, people. And though, given that the idea was debunked, by the Nobel-winning chemist Richard Smalley more than a decade ago, Smalley saw a great potential for nanotech in areas such as clean energy, but his objection to molecular manufacturing, as Drexler described it, was very simple. It ignores the rules of chemistry and physics governing the way atoms bind and react with each other. Smalley admonished Drexler. "You and people around you have scared our children," he says. Oh, you scared the children. Damn, Drexler. Smalley then said, "I don't expect you to stop, but while our future in the real world will be challenging and there are real risks, there will be no such monsters as the self-replicating mechanical nanobots of your dreams," unquote. Oh, my goodness. He did not really say that. Yes, the self-replicating monsters of nanobots of your dreams are becoming real, people. They're working on this stuff in the lab. I have a story about the very first... Apparently, quote unquote, the very first nanobots released in someone's blood. And DARPA put out an RFP looking for people to build the next generation nanofactories. Though Ford does note Smalley's criticism, one begins to wonder whether his conjuring the rise of the robots might not indeed be needlessly scaring our children. Oh, well, that makes sense, because this is MIT Technology Review writing this story. Scaring the children. We must not scare the children. I think I'm going to put that in the title of today's show. Oh. More realistic, he says, but in its way more interesting. The version of the future is being written in downtown Chicago offices of narrative science. It is a software called Quill, and it is able to take data, say the box score of a baseball game or a company's annual report, and not only summarize the context, but extract a narrative from it. Already, Forbes is using this to create some stories about corporate earnings. And now the Associated Press is using a rival's product to write their sports stories, and we read about that as well. The quality is readable and likely to improve greatly in the coming years, so journalists will be out of a job as well. All right, let's read about the gods of technology, because this is a really, really long story, and I see who owns the robots is next. And too often, technology is discussed as if it has come from another planet and just arrived on Earth. Well, sometimes it feels like that way, says Anthony Atkinson, a fellow at Newfield College at the University of Oxford and a professor at the London School of Economics. But the trajectory of technological progress is not inevitable, he says. Rather, it depends on the choices by governments, consumers, and businesses as they decide which technologies get researched and commercialized and how they are used. Well, if that consumer electronics video that I watched yesterday from IBM is any indication of what the future is going to be, IBM Watson is going to be back-ending many, many things and maybe your doctor someday. Atkinson has been studying income inequality since the 1960s. And his new book called Inequality, What Can Be Done, proposes some solutions. First on his list is encouraging innovation in a form that increases the employability of workers. Well, I would say that that would be a good thing, but I doubt that's what any of the governments or corporations are talking about. Because guess what? They don't have to pay robots or software a pension or health insurance or vacation days or sick time. They rarely get hurt or make mistakes. When governments choose what research to fund, yeah, they sprinkle it into DARPA money and put it into universities and hospitals. When governments choose what research to fund and when businesses decide what technologies to use, they are inevitably influencing jobs and income distribution, says Atkinson. It is not easy to see a practical mechanism for picking technologies that favor a future in which more people have better jobs, but we need to ask how these decisions will affect employment. It's a first step, he says, and it might not change the decision, but we will be aware of what is happening, and we don't have to wait until we say, oh dear, people have lost their jobs. Well, that's what they're waiting for. Part of the strategy could emerge from how we think about productivity and what we actually want from machines. Economists traditionally define productivity in terms of output given a certain amount of labor and capital. And as machines and software become ever cheaper and more capable, it makes sense to use less and less human labor. That's why the prominent Columbia University economist Jeffrey Sachs recently predicted that robots and automation would soon take over at Starbucks. But there are good reasons to believe that Sachs could be wrong. The success of Starbucks has never been about getting coffee more cheaply or efficiently. It hasn't. Consumers often prefer people and services humans provide. Really? I don't know about that. If it were fast and cheap, I could guarantee you that people would much prefer some sort of automated barista. All right. Who owns the robots? That's the key question. The effects of automation and digital technology on today's employment picture are sometimes downplayed, and they sure are, by those who point to earlier technology transitions. But it ignores the suffering and the upheaval during those periods. Wages in England were stagnant or fell for around 40 years after the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and the misery of factory workers is well documented in the literature and the political writings of the day. In his new book, The Great Divide, the Columbia University economist Joseph Sligitz suggests that the Great Depression, too, can be traced to technological change. He says that its underlying cause was not, as is typically argued, disastrous government financial policies and a broken banking system, but the shift from an agricultural economy to a manufacturing one. Sligitz describes how the advent of mechanization and improved farming practices quickly transformed the United States from a country that needed many farmers to one that needed relatively few. It took the manufacturing boom fueled by World War II to finally help workers through the transition. Yeah, of course, it was another war that fixed it. And today, he writes, we are caught in another painful transition from manufacturing to a service-based economy. Those who invented the technologies can play an important role in easing the effects. Our way of thinking as engineers has always been brought about, has always been about automation. We wanted to get machines to do as much work as possible, and we wanted to increase productivity, solve engineering problems, and that should be a good thing. But it never occurred to us that it isn't a good thing. Well, so who owns the robots? So whoever owns the capital will benefit as robots and AI inevitably replace many jobs if the rewards of new technology go largely to the very richest, as has been the trend in recent decades, then the dystopian visions could in fact become reality. Ding, ding, ding. But the machines are tools. And if their ownership is more widely shared, which probably won't happen, the majority of people could use them to boost their productivity, increase both their earnings and their leisure. Yeah, like Kurzweil said, we can sit around all day and postulate and be fed grapes by some sex bot. Oh my God. If that happens, the increasing wealthy society could restore the middle class dream that has long driven technological ambition and economic growth. Dun, dun, dun. You know, I don't know, guys. I don't know what to say to this, because the coming robots, you know, I'll tell you where it's going to happen. They're just going to take us and they're going to integrate us into the machine, bridging the bioelectronic divide. New effort by DARPA aims for fully implantable devices that can connect up to 1 million neurons in a human. So you know what? We'll just be the robots. We'll be living and breathing, and we have more dexterity. 2045 project isn't too far into the future. And once we can be programmed, they get rid of all of our needs for healthcare with nanobots in the blood, which, you know what, we didn't get to that story, but we, I guess, are probably going to kick it off tomorrow. Nanobot micromotors deliver medical payloads and living creatures for the very first time. Yes. All right, guys. Well, if you can even believe it, Monday went by really fast. Make sure you stick around, as Lonnie Clark is up next tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern. This week's Our Interesting Times with Tim Kelly, Corbett Report with James Corbett at 7, Unlock the Door at 8, with Michael Cross at 9 p.m. Brand new Truth on the Tracks with Brandon Turberville, Cutting Through the Matrix. This week's show.